Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the few Black-owned radio stations that focus on the solutions of Black communities in America. We Talk Productions present Black Urban America. All you people listening for laptop, the call-in number is 516-531-9540. That's 516-531-9540. On Saturday, our host, Carlton Sneeze, bring on Provocative Thought at 8 p.m. The third Tuesday of each month, Nishore Williams would be doing her own show. And tonight, you have me. And my name is Kenny Jones, host of Black Urban America. Now, before I introduce the guest tonight, I hope everyone is being safe. I know there are many states that lifted the stay-in-shelter ban, but you still have to be careful. I saw on the news people just on top of each other, no masks, no gloves, no 6 feet. I was in the store this past weekend. I was on the line, supposed to be 6 feet away. He up on me. You know, I felt like saying, yo, man, back up. I don't know what you got. You know, you don't even know what I have, if I have it. You know, so we still have to be careful. We are not out of the woods. You have to, and I want to tell you something. The hardest hit, man, is the Black community in America. We're getting hit hard. You ever heard the saying, white America get a cold, Black America gets the flu? But anyway, tonight's guest wrote an interesting book that focusing on using African liberation model to uplift our communities. And the book he wrote is The Politics of Panhoodism. And also, he is the founder, he is the founder of the Black Messiah Movement. Tonight, we have Minister Paul Scott. Welcome, Minister Scott.
We say all praises be to the Creator, all power to his people. In the name of Yahshua, the Black Revolutionary Messiah, I greet you, my brothers and sisters, in the spirit of truth and the words of peace. Shalom Aleichem. How you doing, good brother?
All right. Well, Aleichem Shalom, brother. Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
You had some very interesting comments in your book. Almost finished. I only read half of it. I just want to ask you this. How do we combine social thought within African American communities throughout this nation?
Mm-hmm. And good question, brother. Practical application. That is what has been missing, in my opinion, in the Black community or the so-called Black conscious community since the 60s. Practical application. Your question is very important, brother, because it begs the bigger question. How do we, as those who have read countless books, gone to countless lectures, watched countless YouTube videos from Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, Barry Shango, Steve Coakley, how do we make that relevant to the community? And really, brother, to answer your question very, very straightforward, build with like minds. Panhoodism teaches that the road to uniting all African people starts in your own hood. I'm going to say that one more time. The road to uniting all African people worldwide, Africa, Jamaica, New York, Atlanta, Durham, North Carolina, starts in your own hood. Don't talk to me about 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 miles away. If the brothers and sisters in the street, on the block next to you are shooting each other. So that's my answer to your question, good brother.
Now, let me ask you this. Everything starts in the hood. Can you say that we have to start looking within us as individuals, in the self, improving oneself?
Indeed, because that would be the foundation. The Black Messiah motto is stop waiting for a savior and be one. Stop waiting for a savior and be one. Everybody's looking for somebody else to come save them other than self. They're looking for Malcolm to come back. They're looking for Garvey to come back. They're looking for somebody to come out the clouds to come back. They're looking for Tupac to come back. They're looking for Biggie to come back. Again, the Black Messiah motto is stop waiting for a savior and be one.
So you're saying that we all are the messiahs.
Yes, sir. Because if you look biblically, theologically speaking, Yeshua, who a lot of people call Jesus, but we know his Hebrew name, the name he was given was Yeshua, meaning God brings salvation. That's the translation. He taught that. He taught that. He in the scriptures, he said that you will do these works, and the greater works you shall do. So if you believe in him, so if you are doing the works of a Messiah, that makes you, for all practical purposes, a Messiah. And also, theologically speaking, Yeshua or Jesus wasn't the only Messiah mentioned in the Bible.
Oh, okay. How will you explain that to not everyone's a scholar? Not everyone's the Dr. Clark. Not everyone's the Dr. Ben. Not everyone is a Kwame. Not everyone's a poet. How can you translate or communicate that thought process to the average guy in the hood? Man or woman?
Well, Yes, sir. Well, most of our people come out of the church background. So it's coming straight out the Bible. I mean, I can't make it. If you have a church background, I just say, bring me your Bible where you go to pay that man your 10% of your salary every Sunday. Bring me that same Bible where you're going to that man to teach you what to do and to tell and to talk to God for you and to do something. Ask the God to do something for you. Bring me that same Bible, and I will show you how the teachings of that Bible tell you to do it yourself. And that's as plain as you can make it.
John, you have a question? Michonne?
I'm sorry. Somebody was calling through my phone, and I was trying to get back to the screen where I can answer. Okay,
oh.
I do have some questions. Okay, why do religious institutions overlook black oppression, and how has the black church reacted to your movement? Are they embracing it or not?
Very, and good evening to you too, Queen. Very good question.
This is Minister Paul Scott.
Hello.
Peace. Shalom. I came out of the church. I was ordained a Baptist minister. I was licensed in 1996, ordained in 1998. I started to embrace black liberation theology and left the church in 2002 to hit the streets. Didn't leave the faith, left the building. So that's just given a background, but your question is very important. Let me start with the second part first. How has it been embraced? Largely ignored. To be honest with you. And the reason why I left, actually, the four walls of the church wasn't the traditional, oh, he found out about the blackness of the Bible and he found out that about it was allegory. Yes. But see, I've been studying that long before, studying Barashango, Steve Coakley, Dr. Ben. So that wasn't new to me. But it was the lack of activism within those four walls that made me leave the physical church and hit the street. So I would say that at least locally, I think that a lot of ministers are more concerned with the practical application even than the black theology. I mean, now in 2020, I don't think many of them really are still teaching their congregations about a blue-eyed, blonde-haired Jesus. And then again, some might. I wouldn't know. But I think it's the calling to get beyond the four walls and hit those streets, I think that's what scares them. So I think they would really like to think I don't exist, which is cool with me. The Most High is sufficient. Now, your second question is, repeat it for me, sister, so I can give you a good answer. Hello?
Rashawn?
Why do religious institutions overlook black oppression?
Okay, gotcha. I think it goes back to slavery. Most of the pathologies facing the black community, you can trace them back to the enslavement of our ancestors. Back in the day, they didn't teach us. First, they forbade us to read, first and foremost. They forbade us to read the Bible. So they would send in hand-picked preachers to teach us that the only thing we got to do is get to heaven, is not to steal masses' chickens. That was the only criteria for getting into heaven, was treating the white man right. And you can see how that has bled over into even this generation, where they can so freely kill each other but not mess with the oppressor. So that would be part of it. Secondly, the fact that there was a high illiteracy rate in the black community until recent years, and we still have a relatively high illiteracy rate in some pockets, and people are able to take advantage of you when you can't read. See, we used to hear great-grandma and great-granddaddy say, well, I'm going to pray over this child. I got to pray over the Bible. I got to pray for understanding. But in reality, the reason they were praying for understanding was because they couldn't read. They just didn't want to come out and tell their grandchildren and children that I can't read. So they would say, I got to pray over it, when in actuality, the real reason was they couldn't read.
Okay. And do you think black people will unify even though they have different ideologies?
Let's deal with historical perspective. The brother who was most capable and had the largest movement to do that was the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. He organized anywhere between 6 on the low side and 11 million on the high side African people, regardless of religious schools of thought. His motto was one God, one aim, one destiny. One God, one aim, one destiny. So it is indeed possible. But in the Black Messiah movement, we have an acronym for miracle. And we say miracle stands for manifesting in reality, a clear living example. Manifesting in reality, a clear living example. And when that's your base principle, you don't argue over the next man's religion, because you're more concerned about the works of your own religion. And I think under those principles, we can unify. And by the way, Marcus Garvey was a Catholic. A lot of people don't know that. Marcus Garvey was a Catholic, but he worked with other religions as well, especially the Hebrew Israelites.
And also,
or the
black
Jews, as they were called back then. I'm sorry about
that. Yeah, you know, also, Malcolm X said that, you know, I might be a Muslim minister. I have here a Baptist minister. Over here, I have a Methodist minister. But we have one thing in common. We're black men, and we have one common enemy. Now, I just want to switch the focus of the questioning. Why do you think, Brother Minister, that there's just a high level on black violence?
Self-hatred. Self-hatred would be the best answer. And unfortunately, if you look at our literature, our scholars, there isn't a whole lot of work on the issue. The best two books I can think of that deal with black on black violence or black self-inflicted wounds. Dr. Amos Wilson has a book called Black on Black Violence, and Dr.
Yeah.
Bobby E. Wright has a book, The Psychopathic Racial Personality. Those are really the only two books I can think of that really deal with that. Our young people have been taught to hate themselves. Mama was taught to hate herself. Daddy was taught to hate himself. Grandma, great-grandmother, and so on. We have to break that cycle. So in the Black Messiah movement, we have a process that's called raising our people from the dead. Now, we're not talking about going to the graveyard and picking up a shovel and digging dead bodies. No, we're talking about spiritual and mental death. And it's also called raising our people out of the N-word degree. I don't want you to get in trouble with the censor, so I just say N-word because I know how Facebook and all the social media is doing right now with their algorithms. But we have four steps. Step number one, because a lot of our young people identify with that word, and more so with the word. I'm not as concerned with the word as I am with the behavior that's attached to and glorified in that word. So we have a four-step process. Step number one, make them identify with acting like the N-word. Make them identify, accept it, kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. I am behaving like the N-word, and some of them are real proud of that. Step number two, give them the history of the word, how it was really given to African people by the Portuguese in the 14th century, as an adjective meaning the black and the negative connotations. Step number three, make them internalize that they're acting like what it really means to behave like the N-word, and make it hit home, make it personal. Do you want your daughter to grow up and say her daddy was the N-word? Is your mama proud of you being the N-word? When you die, do you want the preacher at your funeral to say he died a real N? And number four, give them another sense of identity. They've been told all their lives they're nothing but ends. So we got to give them once we take that identity away from them, we got to replace it with another identity. You're either a black king, a black queen, or in our movement, you're a black messiah.
And you know what, too, Minister, that when you hear the average sister talk today and describe her partner, her male partner, more often she describes him, that's my N, instead of saying, that's my man, that's my husband, that's my boyfriend, whatever. They say, that's my N. Is that all part of it too? That the we call out women, the H word, the B word, and they call the men the N-word.
Yeah, I mean, hip-hop had a lot to do with that. If you look at the impact that N.W.A. had on the black community and were never really called out for it, they really had a lot to do with that glorification of them.
Ice Cube is a multimillionaire, and he went on a couple of shows like 2 years ago and said, yeah, well, black folks have embraced that word. It's our word now. I said, man, what are you talking about? And I know this musician, right? He said, and we were talking about hip-hop one day. This is a few years ago. He said, and I said, well, N.W.A. was all right. He said, yeah, well, N.W.A., that's when we all became the H and the N's.
Mm-hmm. But in all fairness, and we'll get back to N.W.A. in a second. Back in early 1960s, I think it was like 1961, like 1962, around that year, there was a white Jewish or a white person of the Jewish religion named Lenny Bruce, a comedian.
Yeah.
So 20 years before N.W.A. came out with it, he was glamorizing the word, and in his warped sense of thinking, he said that if I say the word, it'll take the sting out of it. So we can't totally blame N.W.A., but we can hold them accountable too. But I think the first person who really
one of our comedian geniuses, Richard Pryor, his first album, That End Is Crazy. His first album. Until he went to Africa and had a divine moment and came back, he said he's going to stop using that word in his stand-up. He would use that word for years.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, brother. But getting back to the N.W.A. thing, you can't mention Ice Cube, Dre, Ren, Yella, and the rest of them, and Easy, without mentioning the brains behind the operation. The white Jewish dude, Jerry Heller.
Yeah, he got a bad reputation.
Yeah, Jerry Heller was the brains behind the operation. So they have always, and I'm talking about white people in general, the European in general, they have always made money from our destruction. So we can't mention N.W.A. without mentioning Jerry Heller. And I suggest everybody peeps his autobiography called Ruthless. There's some strong confessions he makes in that book as far as the role that he played in the conspiracies to destroy black people.
Hmm. Meshawn, you have a question? I don't think Meshawn knows who N.W.A. is.
I do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know I do. Okay. What can we do about the economic exploitation in our community?
Well, one of the things that we can do is take control of our communities. We have, and I mentioned part of that in the book, Politics of Panhoodism, to take control of the economics of our communities.
Rick Ross in the background. Hold up. I hear the noise. Anybody hearing that noise?
Yeah, I hear a click.
It's not me. I don't know what that click is coming from, but let's go anyway.
Yes, sir. One of the things that and I lost my chain of... Hold on one second. Put me on mute for a second and see if it's my phone, brother.
Okay. Hey, I didn't know you knew about N.W.A. I thought you was a rock and roll fan. You know who NWA was?
Of course.
Do you know who Public Enemy was?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. I should have had
that. Okay,
noise.
Brother, did it? Okay, did it stop when you put me on mute?
It stopped? No, it didn't. We kept on going.
Okay. Okay, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't my phone.
Now, let me see if it's me, Sean. That's you, Miss Sean.
It's me.
Yes? Well, I put you on mute, the noise that stopped.
I don't know what that is then.
See, it stopped. It stopped. Right, Minister?
Yes, sir.
It stopped, didn't it?
Yes, sir.
Well, for sure, you got to do something about that. That's disrupted the whole flow. I'll bring you back on in a couple of minutes, see if the noise stops. You know, maybe out there with the cows or something, because you live in the farmland. Go ahead, Brother Minister. Go ahead. We was talking about how Jerry Eller wrote in the Book of Ruth, he made a confession that he played a role in the destruction. Press one, Carlton, if you want to come on. The destruction of the black community, or bring it down the black community,
yes,
and whatnot. Let me stay on hip-hop a little bit, because you focus in on a lot of hip-hop in your book and what have you. Why do you think that the entertainment industry plays such a huge role in portraying some of our stereotypes? Like, we all are gangster. I know a couple gangsters in my lifetime, but I ain't never been a gangster. And all our women are single mothers. Well, we do have a large population, 72% and everything, but most of them are striving. Yet there are some that are not striving, they are just surviving. But why do they want to portray us always in the negative life and glorify it?
That goes back to the minstrel shows with Al Jolson and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
They've always glorified the negativity. It's been written that during the minstrel shows and the blackface days, they were actually living vicariously through their characters as black people. And we still see that same energy going today. They try to live vicariously through us. That's one reason. And the second reason is you kill two birds with one stone. You brainwash us, or as Dr. Bobby E. Wright says, you create menticide, and then you make money at the same time. So it's really killing two birds with one stone, brother.
So basically, what you're saying is, mass media is not good for our souls.
No, sir.
Oh, I want to introduce everyone to Carlton. I want to welcome Carlton Sneed, host of Provocative Thought, and join in with us tonight. Too bad you couldn't meet me, Sean. She got some tick, tick, tick going on. What's up, Carlton? Carlton? Oh, I guess something must be wrong with these controls. I guess it's just you and me. Why do you feel? Oh, here he is. That's you, Carlton?
Yeah, it's me. How you doing?
All right. Yeah. Welcome. because of provocative. Why do you feel, Brother Minister, that we need to bring back black nationalism?
I think that if you look historically,
and the reason why,
before
you start to respond to that, a lot of people feel that we should still be in the liberalism. A lot of people feel that we should be Democrats or Republicans. A lot of people feel that we should have the mentality of being diverse, which is a code word, diverse. And so why you feel that we should bring back the black naturalist thought?
If you look at the black struggle historically, that's the only thing that has ever worked. In the context of, we talked about black-on-black violence, that is the only thing that has ever worked. You can take it back to Martin Delaney, who many say is the father of black nationalism. Bring it up through Garvey. Bring it up through Kwame Ture and Black Power. Bring it through Public Enemy and Boogie Down Productions and X-Clan. Bring it through the Nation of Islam. Bring it to the Million Man March. The only thing that's ever really worked in empowering our community is black nationalism. And the importance of that, brother, black nationalism didn't just fade out. It was destroyed. They have always tried to destroy black nationalism. Even before J. Edgar Hoover said he wanted to prevent the rise of a black messiah who could unite the black community. It had been done before to destroy black nationalism. Look at the attacks on Garvey's movement. Some people would even argue, scholars would even argue, that the whole Harlem Renaissance was set up to destroy Garvey's movement. They had the Whistle Campaign, the Talented Tenth, the Whisper Campaign, to Garvey Must Go, to get Garvey deported because he was teaching black nationalism. The NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the NAACP, they were against Garvey's black nationalism. Joel Spingard, who was one of the early white Jewish leaders of the NAACP, came up with something called neoliberalism. No, excuse me, non-economic liberalism. And what non-economic liberalism coming out of the NAACP taught was, you can integrate a toilet, you can integrate a movie theater, you can integrate a lunch counter, but one thing you can't do is start your own business. You want to know why black people, we always fight for integration and being included instead of doing for ourselves? It's because of Joel Spingarn and the NAACP non-economic liberalism. That was the trade-off. You can integrate, but you can't start, can't work for self-improvement and self-empowerment.
Are they afraid that if black America becomes financially independent, where the other culture, are they afraid of that? Are they afraid of black folks in America? Because they're not afraid of other black folks in the world being independent. But why are they so afraid of the financial independency of black America?
Because we're in the belly of the beast. And, you know, it's easy to destroy the beast if you're in the belly of the beast. All you got to do is stop feeding the beast, and the beast will be destroyed. They know that their whole financial system United States and Britain. Their whole financial system was based on the enslavement of our people. And it has to be maintained, since it was built on the enslavement of our people, it has to be maintained by the perpetual enslavement of our people. Everybody should read Eric Williams' book, Capitalism and Slavery. That is a must read. Capitalism and Slavery by Eric Williams. It really breaks down the economics of slavery. But again, to answer your question, because the foundation, it was built on the enslavement of African people, that can't stop. Because if that's your foundation, if you break that master-slave, slave-master relationship, your whole society will crumble because it's based on that foundation.
Mm. Carlton, you have a question?
No, amen to that. And I just wanted to shout out to the Black Panther Party. I'm thinking you mentioned them in terms of...
Oh, Black Panthers is very notorious when it comes to Black nationalism. Very notorious. Malcolm X, too. Malcolm X was very notorious on Black nationalism.
And on the N-word, in terms of... I can't blame NWA for that, because I know when I was a young boy, we used it all the time. You know, so, I mean, it wasn't no rap.
But it became commercialized. You cannot listen to a song.
We use it all the time. We use it like brother. That was interchangeable with brother. It was just like they said now, term of endearment. Then you can say it in another way, and you hear somebody saying that, and you better start running because you're about to get something. You understand what I'm saying? So, you know, and then, it, you know, use the word all the time. You know, way before NWA. So I'm not saying they didn't help perpetuate certain behaviors and characteristics and stereotypes about a certain segment of our population, because all of us are not, like, you know, off the chain and stuff like that. So that's a certain segment of Black population. That's not all. That's not Black people. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to say who uses the word or who doesn't use the word or how they use it, but, you know, like they say now they've embraced that, and I hear people of different ethnicities are using the same word, not just towards black people, towards each other. Like, it might be too Caucasian. You understand what I'm saying? They're talking like that. So they, like, you know, they got a little thing that they do that's a little different than the way we came up under that word. You know what I'm saying? But in the same respect, you know, I'm not going to blame gangster rap on that. And we have to take responsibility. As we were saying, speaking about earlier today, we have to take responsibility for what we do, each and every one of us. You know, so we've got to be able to turn, you know, we want to turn this thing around, start with you. Each one reach one. Start with you, then somebody close to you, you know, somebody coming in contact with you. And don't try to force it on nobody, because if you do that, you know, especially nowadays, you can end up either in jail or dead. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, start with just my thing. Start with you, then reach out to somebody else.
Interesting points, brother. I have a slight different perspective on the original Black Panthers. I do not consider them a Black nationalist organization. Coringa's group, for better or worse, was Black nationalists. The Panthers were mostly, and with the exception of maybe New York. Maybe New York was more Black nationalist based. But the Black Panthers, for a large part, they were based on Marxism. They were based on the teaching of Karl Marx. And just like the Communist Party, the Black Communists, when you're dealing with a Marxist ideology, they kind of trade off Black nationalism for interracial cooperation, classism. They're dealing with classism more so than Black nationalism. That's why you very rarely heard Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale reference a Marcus Garvey. You very rarely saw them, if ever, with a red, black, and green flag. Their thing was basically dealing with capitalism and that system more so than Black nationalism.
Well, you know, my brother was a Black Panther.
My brother's a Black Panther. He had a red, black, and green flag hanging up in his room.
They had that. But it's not like
you
said that they had their own symbols.
Oh, but it was more political thought, though. But their practices.
Right, they were dealing
with. Their practices were more or less unifying the Black community. And that's all about Black nationalism, unifying the Black community.
Mm-hmm. But one of the downfalls of the original Black Panthers was just that. Their involvement with white folks. I'm talking about the Jane Fondas, the Marlon Brandos. That kind of leaned more towards the idea of everybody coming together, crushing capitalism, more so than Black nationalism. Leonard Bernstein, all these white philanthropists that contributed to the original Black Panther, again, not taking anything away from them. I'm just talking about the difference between them and
mm-hmm.
orthodox Black nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I respect, and just let me be clear. I respect the works of everybody fighting for our freedom. I'm not really going to even say which philosophy was the best, but just there is a distinction between the UNIA and that legacy and the Black Panther Party and that legacy. Remember, the Black Panthers used to quote Chairman Mao a lot and the Little Red Book also Karl Marx. That was more socialist based than Black nationalist based. Now, if you want to talk about a socialist Black nationalist combination, you would deal with Kwame Ture, who was an honorary member of the Black Panthers at one point.
He followed Nkrumah.
Kwame Nkrumah was one of his mentors who combined African tradition with socialism, but he kind of called it African communalism. So there has been if you look at Kwame Ture, read Ready for Revolution, read that book by Dr. I think his last name is Purnell, called I. Stokely, read the speeches of Stokely Carmichael. Those will give you some insight in how he tried to fuse or was successful in fusing the ideas of Marxism as well as African communalism.
I want to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
In one of your statements, you stated economic, ethnic cleansing.
Yes, sir.
Explain that for us.
The term gentrification is now comfortable for white folks. They're comfortable saying gentrification. It is almost a household word right now. You see these white groups, even in Durham, North Carolina, talking about we need to
everywhere,
get gentrification.
Everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere.
So, but economic ethnic cleansing speaks more directly to the Ma'afa or the Black Holocaust. Economic ethnic cleansing. If there are studies, there are books written about Black communities being total disappearing. One minute they had Black people, next minute the Black people were gone.
Mm-hmm.
They set up the economic conditions to get rid of Black people. You can look at Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, Durham, North Carolina, Black Wall Street. One was bombed to get rid of Tulsa's Black Wall Street, to get rid of Durham, North Carolina's Black Wall Street. They ran out. They did other things economically, but the outcome was the same: to destroy that economic base, which resulted in the creation of the hood in many cases.
Name one thing they did to get rid of the one in Durham, because I never knew about you know, how that ended.
Mm-hmm. So, there are a couple of things. Well, first of all, first of all, we have to be honest. People in Durham especially have to be honest about what Black Wall Street meant. All black people did not benefit from Black Wall Street. Durham has a strong black middle class and prides itself on having a strong black middle class. But the trade-off was they couldn't really promote the African-centered or the black militant thing and deal with the black middle class at the same time. That was a division. That division still exists in 2020. A lot of people are familiar with Black Wall Street, but they're not familiar with Dr. Howard Fuller, whose movement created the Malcolm X Liberation University. A lot of people in Durham are not even familiar that we even had a Malcolm X Liberation University. And these are people who lived in Durham. So that part of the Black Wall Street has been elevated, but the black radical tradition or the more militant tradition, that's been totally almost whited out. Now, as far as your question, how did they get rid of Black Wall Street? Economically, some people will point to the creation of Highway 147, which is the highway that separated the black part of Durham from the white part of Durham. No, excuse me. They ran a highway that split the black community. That's better stated. They developed a highway that split the black community. So that is one way they destroyed the remnants of Black Wall Street, which we call the Hayti area. That's one thing they did.
You said that not everybody benefited from it because of the trade-off?
Yeah, not everybody benefited from it because the black middle class, you know, classism exists in many communities. And if you notice, the black middle class really stays away from the whole black power thing. So you see the same thing happening in Durham.
Hold on, brother. Yes. Hold on, brother, minister.
Excuse me
for cutting you off.
No problem.
I don't think so much of the black middle class, maybe the black upper class, because in Harlem at one time we had this section called Strive Up. All you had black actors, actresses, black big corporate owners, business owners. And I don't know. It depends on their thinking process. Look at Harry Belafonte. Look at Chuck Booth. He's a millionaire.
It's always exceptional.
And he's full-blooded liberation.
Right, but if you look at, like the brother said, there are exceptions to the rule. But if you look at the masses of our people, there's still that divide between the lower economic class and the middle class. That is the most pronounced division. We don't have that many, relatively speaking, millionaires in the black community. But we have a large lower economic class and a kind of, especially in Durham, we have a kind of thriving middle class. And that conflict always is there because being in the middle class historically meant some form of cooperation with the white power structure. Some form of cooperation with the white power structure. And cooperation with the white power structure, some things just can't happen. Some things just can't happen. That's why you see all these conflicts between the black bourgeoisie and the black nationalist or the black militant community.
Well, how can we... I'm going to bring this question up again, like I did at the beginning of the show. How can we get somebody from that sector, the black middle class to start thinking Afrocentric, or start thinking black liberation, that their skills could benefit the black community by starting their own things, starting their own businesses, mentoring, or whatever, putting the energy back into the black community. How can we get that class? Because a lot of folks, for what you're saying, a lot of folks just go to their job, come home and just deal with their family, just deal with their world, and like, hey, I got mine. You got to get yours, right, type of thinking.
Yeah, that's what Tupac and that's what Tupac said. I got to get mine. You got to get yours. You just brought me back to that. But it's a matter of what your purpose on this earth is, and that goes beyond economics. If you are really about the liberation of black people, because just because you are in the lower economic class does not mean you're necessarily for the liberation of black people. You might be you might be in the lower economic class, but your whole objective might be to be in the middle class, which is one of the lures of the drug trade. Because if you remember Jet Magazine back in the day, they would glorify hustlers to a degree. Because read E. Franklin Frazier's book, The Black Bourgeoisie, excellent book, Black Bourgeoisie by Franklin. Excellent book. There is a segment that in the black community has always said, whichever way you got to get it to get that money, get it. That's not only the drug dealers. You're talking about back in the 40s, 30s, and 40s. That was still a mentality that whichever way it takes to get you to the black middle class, do that. Do that. But unfortunately, when you're dealing in that with that mentality, your morals kind of go out the window. Because you have that get rich or die trying 50 cent type attitude. And if you half your people or most of your people got to die for you to eat, so be it. So be it. So your question was, how can we get beyond that? Garvey said it. Going back to Marcus Garvey. One God, one aim, one destiny. I think Garvey gave us the best formula. One God, one aim, one destiny, because Garvey had all kind of people from various economic backgrounds in his
family. He had a hustler or two with successful. Him too now. He had a couple of gangsters with him.
And
he had a couple gangsters with him on that board.
Right. And, you know, the Nation of Islam, they have people from various economic. No, I'm talking about it. Well, I'm just saying from various backgrounds, economic backgrounds.
Right.
But they have a common mission. They have a common mission. So if you have a common mission, then you can go across the economic divide if you have a common mission. But again, that goes back to Garvey, one God, one aim, one destiny.
All right, hold up, Brother Minister. We have a caller that have a question for you. Let me chime him in. Okay, welcome to Black Herb America, 4159. What's your question or comment?
Assalamu alaikum. Not a question. I just wanted to let you know I was in queue.
What's up? Walaikum salam. Oh, okay.
The minister just said something that's interesting when he mentioned about Garvey, because as of now, it seemed like they're taking that same plan. One currency, one government, one God, one religion. And they're placing that on everyone. So thinking of what you asked, how can we get by this or move upon this? From my understanding perception, I don't think we can. I think it all needs to fall. I think as far as for our people, we got to fall from the grace. We got to be in the trenches. Because the people have forgotten that we're in a war. So they need to see, okay, we got a battle now. We got to be forced into doing what we did prior. See, I'm only 57. So from what I understand of it is, from the 60s and 70s, we still had to struggle. It was still there. As we got into the 80s and people moved away from the community and they became neighborhoods and less than neighborhoods now, people integrated. There was no struggle. You know what I mean? You can get the job. Mm-hmm. You start off at $375 an hour, and then you get your job, and you make more, and you move out away from your family, away from your community, because you don't see the struggle no more. You're chasing their financial system. You're chasing their dream, what they say the dream is, all along forgetting that you're in a war. So what I see is we need to still understand we're not out of the war. We're still in a war. But this generation today don't see that. They don't feel that war because they have the wage. They have the products. They have the leisure. And they're not of importance anymore because the cities are built. The technology is used. You know, we went from being the producers to the consumers. Mm-hmm. So they don't really have a need. Don't have a need for us. So now it's extinction time. We got to get rid of them because the numbers are unfair now. The European numbers are dying down. They're in survival mode, and we're in party mode. Until we get out of party mode, get back to war mode, then we can actually start thinking because it won't even be money that's going to help us because the money's not worth anything now. It's crashing. So we're going to have to go back to square one. It's going to have to be community. It's going to have to be survival tactics, you know. And it's not going to be everyone that's going to be on board. A lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to fall. But I don't think we have that opportunity. You know, I don't mean to be so pessimistic, but this is their plan. They have their plan in motion. The problem is that every time we're planning something, they've already planned on how to get past whatever we're going to think of to come up with a solution to the plan because they're constantly planning. They're constantly at war. And he found a way to keep us at leisure. Like you said, whether it was the minstrel shows or the movies or the music and entertainment, they found a way to keep us asleep. And the other part to that is they found a way to keep us chasing after something that they controlled, and that was the dollar. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just my input. I really do see that this all has to crash, and it's going to take individual families, individual groups, and people of like minds, you know, to start rebuilding and grouping. But we're going to lose a lot of people also because they're just not with it.
Well, that's what happened, Ward. We lose people. We only got 2 minutes left. Brother Minister, could you get everybody
yes,
your information if they want to, you know, order your book and stuff like that and what have you? And how they make contact?
Indeed. Well, actually, I'm giving the book out for free. It's a PDF. So if you want a copy, just email me at info@nowarningshotsfired.com. That's info@nowarningshotsfired.com. And you can also follow me on Facebook, and that's under Minister Paul Scott.
Brother, I thank you for coming on the show. You've been very
the
enlightening.
The honor is mine, sir.
And I got to have you back at pretty soon. And I'd like to thank all of the listeners from Laptop Land and from the phones and everything. And I'd like to tell everyone, be safe. Enjoy your family. Do not put yourself in danger. And good night to everyone.
Peace.
Peace.
Peace out.
Enjoy my Muslim brothers and sisters. I'd like to say assalamu alaikum to y'all and have a good night. And shalom to my Israelite brothers and sisters and everything. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night, everyone. Have a prosperous week.